Once again, dear Dhamma friends who are here in India, in New Delhi, here at Kibi, as well as then all of the viewers around the world as well. To all of you, I wish you a very good day, also a very good evening as well, wherever you are. So, as I was saying yesterday, is that from the from the aspect of developing the enlightened attitude. Yesterday the topic came from the refuge vows, basically, yes, that in order to liberate ourselves from karma, klesha, and habitual patterns, that to begin with we are required to generate or depend on the various vows, namely that of the three different types of vows: the pratikmoksha vows, the bodhisattva, the vow of the bodhisattvas, and the vow of the other tantric vows. So, in order to so from the three different types of vows, or levels of vows, one could say, which will enhance our quality, which will enhance our let's say inherent quality, inner quality, it's better to say, I think, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have shown in the past over and over again through various activities that by utilizing these vows, then one can truly enhance our inherent qualities. So today or the next few days, the subject that we are talking about is that of the Bodhisattva, the way of the Bodhisattva, which is the translation in English, and or in Sanskrit the Buddhacharya Avatara. It basically focuses on how to cultivate the inherent quality, namely that of the bodhicitta, the enlightened nature, let's say. The nature that that can be very vividly seen in all sentient beings, no matter what kind of condition we are in. In many of the teachings of the realized beings have repeated over and over again that whether we are human beings, whether we are born as animals, or any other forms of sentient beings or realms of sentient beings, that that the very nature that we are talking about, this enlightened nature, this inherent nature, is always visible, even though it may be obscured by karma, klesha, and so on. That it's always visible. That at most confusing situations and times, such quality is always visible. And I think one of the traditional analogies is always that of the care and the love that is expressed by someone who's very, ferocious and very fearsome, mainly due to karma and klesha. But no matter how, ferocious, you know, one's temporary condition is, that one can still express love and kindness for one's own cubs. So even though it may be very limited, and those qualities, those sort of very coarse maybe signs of qualities, is still always visible. And so just like that, there are so many as a visible signs, you know, that this nature is there, and it's something that does not need to be implemented or taught, simply because it's inherent. It's already there in terms of as a potential, you know, as a quality. And so they said that it's obscured temporarily. Also, the obscuration is not permanent, that it's just, you know, temporarily. Temporary meaning that it's temporary because it's always changing. It's never permanent. So therefore, so such forces or such obscurations have basically sealed that quality. And so therefore it's not visible. So it is exactly due to that reason that once we have the favorable conditions, such as having the precious human body and so on, and of course the Buddha Dharma within our grasp, let's say, then it is crucial that we apply these methods, such as the Bodhisattva's attitudes, developing the Bodhisattva's attitude, because these will then enhance the inherent quality and help to also remove these obscurations, and then finally then our qualities will become clearer and clearer. So now the great or Mahabodhisattva, Shantideva, has then composed this wonderful teaching. I think here he was from the 8th century, and a great, scholar, and basically known for his compassion, you know, for that exact reason that his name was also Shantideva, Shanti basically means compassion or peace. Deva is basically, you know, the excellence or the highest quality, or let's say the deity, let's say, you know. So throughout his life, and then as with all the great Bodhisattvas, realized Bodhisattvas, has benefited countless of beings by the quality of his compassion and wisdom, and of course through these timeless teachings. And these teachings have benefited not only, you know, beings within his time and within his era, but over the centuries, dating to now, let's say, you know. So whoever has heard, contemplated, practiced his teachings have had great benefit in terms of at least one has had the benefit of establishing a virtuous connection, planting a virtuous seed in one's heart. Of course, on top of it, then one gains inspiration that everything in life can be conquered by compassion, that it can be conquered by loving kindness. And it is, I think, a timeless teaching that really touches all sentient beings, no matter whether one is a follower of the Buddha or Bodhisattva, that from any cultural background, any region of the world, no matter what, that it's a teaching and that truly inspires one's own ability and quality to overcome, you know, the various of challenges that we face nowadays. Of course, starting from, let's say, survival, yes, to basically the point where we really want to understand our origin, or the origins of various factors, origins or causes, basically causes of happiness and causes of unhappiness and so on. So to describe all of this in a very simple way, and also how to achieve a peaceful and a meaningful life, this teaching is able to really convey in the most simplest of ways of achieving it. So last year we have talked, we sort of briefly went through the first chapter, which was basically talking about the benefit of the bodhicitta, you know. First of all, understanding what it is, and then cultivating it so that it gives inspiration, first of all. And then once you have inspiration, then you are motivated to do so. So therefore we have gone through that chapter, and in here it is known as the chapter of purification. Basically the whole text has 10 chapters, and the way that is sort of put together is that basically there's a very well-known famous shloka which says that that may we generate or give rise to the bodhicitta if there is no, let's say, cultivation. And if one has already given rise to it, then maybe make sure that it never, falters. And then lastly, maybe also transcend or basically develop this wonderful cultivation of bodhicitta. So this particular prayer or aspiration shloka basically, I think, describes, it's a very simple way to summarize the Shantideva's Bodhicitta Avatara, that the first three chapters basically focuses on generating bodhicitta, if one has not generated yet. And then the next three chapters focuses on how to sort of now protect it, how to make sure that it doesn't get damaged. And then the next three chapters then focuses on making sure that it develops further, you know, so that one obtains the perfect enlightenment. So of course, through these three types of, let's say, aspirations, then one generates, one would automatically, naturally, even if you just go through it as a course, let's say, as a study, that already we would accumulate, you know, immense merit. And so the last chapter, the 10th chapter, is a way to dedicate all of that merit to all sentient beings. So right now, or this time, the second chapter focuses on basically giving rise or cultivating or generating bodhicitta. So now, normally when we attend a teaching or an initiation or any kind of I would like to call it dharmic, you know, Buddha dharmic event, it is most important that unless we are completely new to it and we are coming there for the to discover and out of our curiosity, otherwise, if you are familiar with it, then it is very important that first of all our mindset is, you know, correct. So therefore, mindset of the listener and the mindset of the the deliverer, let's say, or the teacher. So both would have to have proper mindset. So, of course, those are not very difficult to understand. Simply what we need is to generate a positive intention that through this receiving of the teaching or the Buddha Dharma, that may I benefit all sentient beings, you know, by listening, by contemplating, and by means of application, that I will benefit sentient beings. If not now, later. You know? So, at least to have that kind of intention. If one has it, then it's already very good. There is already a very good condition, a good atmosphere. And similarly, also the one who delivers also has to have the same intention, and that one is also teaching it for a good cause, you know, for the benefit of all sentient beings. If not now, later, you know. So, with no pressure, of course, but at least to have the proper, to have a proper mindset is very, very important. Otherwise, as I said yesterday, it can really sort of waste that time, that opportunity. Because these teachings are, of course, not just, you know, composed out of boredom or out of just having too much time in one's hand and so on. But in fact, it is really composed from a great understanding, a great direct experience of how direct experience of the bodhicitta, let's say. So therefore, it's a pure reflection. So therefore, if he just sort of don't pay the proper or the due respect to it, then it's a great loss. That's the thing. Yeah, it's a waste and a great loss. Loss for ourselves, and also loss for others as well, because if one has wasted this opportunity, equally, each of us has, we all have responsibility to the rest as well. So therefore, losing, it's a great loss for both of us. So therefore, we must have proper mindset to begin with, and as always, at the end, then we dedicate our merits, which is also very important. These are very simple ways and methods to accumulate a great amount of positive karma or good karma by very simple and skillful means, in a very short amount of time. So therefore, then the dedication is also very important. And while listening, of course, now. So the beginning is already very virtuous. The conclusion is also very virtuous. And now also, the middle should be also equally virtuous. And that is by simply giving full attention. Yes. So, having said that, and then I will recite the taking of refuge and the generating of the four immeasurables, and then we can all recite together. And then meditate and visualize that we are taking refuge from the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha for the benefit of all sentient beings. Particularly when we think of the sentient beings, think of their various states. Certain obvious states, such as some states where one is extremely lost and confused, and by focusing on that we will have an immediate sort of reaction, let's say, and that reaction is coming simply from our inherent nature, inherent quality, a sense of compassion. Maybe to begin with, maybe a sense of pity, let's say. And we can use that to begin with, and then we try to think of not just one or two, but then try to think of more. And so maybe to begin with, to think of those maybe who are ill, think of those maybe who are in severe states, such as by illness, hunger, war, and so on. Then the kind of, mental state that they're in, try to sort of reflect on that. And then, in a similar way, one could say we also think of the sentient beings maybe who are maybe little less confused, And then think of also their state, in terms of what is happening, what kind of also what types or what kinds of confusions that they must be also going through. So like that, then we can think of, you know, various stages of confusions of sentient beings. And then we basically trying to generate compassion at all, on all of these subjects, let's say, you know, and or basically states of confused mind or consciousness, and then try to sort of relate to them, if possible, let's say, equally, and if really possible, then to think of them even more than, let's say, one's own oneself. So in that way, then try to sort of relate to all sentient beings, and then for their sake, then tell yourself that I'm right now listening and giving, sort of generating my awareness to receive this teaching for their sake.
Sanje chadon soje chonam la chanjo bardon dane jazun je dage jin soje be sanam je dolam pen sanje ro bara sho sanje chadon soje chonam la chanjo bardon dane dage jin soje be sanam je dolam pen jira sanje ro bara sho sanje chadon soje chonam la chanjo bardon dane jazun je dage jin soje be sanam dolam pen jira sanje ro bara sho semjian tamjian dewa dan dewen jo dan dembra jo jian donghara dan donghara jian jo dan dalura ji dewa dan ba dan men da ro jo jian nyerin cha dan ni dan dawe dan nyum chen bo la ne bro jo ro ji semjian tamjian dewa dan dewe jo dan dembra jo jian donghara dan donghara jian jo dan dalura jo jian donghara me ben dewa dan ba dan men da ro jo jian nyerin cha dan ni dan Tanyam chenpolan nebaran churun jen, semjian tamjian dewa dan dewe judan denbaran churjian, donghan dan donghan jen, judan dalbaran churjian, donghan meben. Dalbaran churjian nirin chadan nidan dravyan, tanyam chenpolan nebaran churun jen. Namalaya gadam, nudan nujin gandavum dadam, miyigan undan, dova kunjian dake chizan batam jen, gedo dambe chudan to, badin tsaya namaran bajan, dake chivab mele jen. Kadin chenpo kwenen jesunta kusanta jengwa tazado so.
So within this now chapter of the purification, it first begins with the section, let's say, of offering. So we are basically beginning with the most beautiful part. Not that it's not beautiful later on, but to begin with, basically it focuses on accumulating merit, basically. Accumulation of merit is very important. It is said that without merit, then it is impossible for us to have this time, this positive condition. Even if I just able to have a moment of quietness, you know, a moment of peace, yes, nothing to do with spirituality. If you're able to experience that, it means that it is a result of you know, direct merit. So, therefore, it's important for us to learn this method or the art of accumulating merit, and not just plain merit, but in the most profound way, yes, in the ways of the Bodhisattvas, so that a simple accumulation of a merit is turned into something, something amazing. So therefore, this is now what is being taught here. So I'm sure you all have various translations of the root text. So therefore, maybe some may have a little, some may be a little different from the other in terms of the translation. So therefore, later on, it would be good if you sort of compare. If you have different copies, it's good, so that you can compare the meanings. Yeah. So now in here, it begins with. So now I'll just simply read. To the Buddhas, those thus gone, and to the sacred Dharma, spotless and supremely rare, and to the Buddha's offspring, oceans of good qualities, that I might gain this precious attitude, I make a perfect offering. So, now in here, if I remember correctly, there are this offering has also, let's say, various ways of offering that depending on let's say what is possible to offer. Sometimes we may have the condition and the opportunity to offer things. Sometimes we may not, you know, it depends. So therefore, such as these great Bodhisattvas, they have, how to say, been extremely, let's say, helpful in terms of, let's say, making it engageable, easy for all sentient beings, you know, so that any one of us can engage in this practice of offering. So in here it is I think it begins with the offering of basically, you know, offerings, or the object of offerings that belongs to us, you know, that has an owner, let's say, you know, such as a candle that is, let's say, your own candle or your own flower and so on, you know, something that you can offer. And there, of course, various others that is not necessarily belonging to anyone, but what to say, simply there. And you can also offer that also to accumulate merit. So in here, offering the things to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, you know, that is, let's say, in a relative aspect that is belonging to us. So now to the Buddhas and those that's gone, as well as the Dharma, and then the Buddha's offering. So basically describing the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, yes, the refuge, because to whom you offer, yes, it is very important. Of course we can offer to sentient beings, we can offer to those who are in need, and that will also accumulate immense merit, actually timeless merit. But to begin with, yes, to begin with, it is very important that we offer things to those that brings inspiration, that brings courage. If you offer to someone like that of the Buddha, and then we know that that is a how do you call this? The merit is unfailing, let's say, you know, the return. Because right now we are in need of a merit, you know, more merit, yes? Not just a few merits, but a lot. You know, timeless, you know, we need tons, you know, countless of merit. So, therefore, to begin with, we need to begin where it is very inspiring for us. So, therefore, if you think of the qualities of the Buddha, the qualities of the Dharma, as well as the Sangha in this case, particularly that of the realized Bodhisattvas, then the merit is, the accumulation of merit is unfailing, it's flawless. So therefore, then we meditate that we have not just one Buddha, but countless of Buddhas of past, present and future. Past, present and future, of course, these are just ways of describing from our current perspective, yes? Not that they're, but not in any other way. So, meaning past in terms of from our present point of view, such as that of the Buddha Kashyapa and so on, you know, we could consider them as, you know, Buddhas of the past, Shakyamuni Buddha, you know, the Buddhas of present, Buddha Maitreya and so on, you know, Buddhas of, you know, future Buddhas and so on. It's just according to our perspective, then we can see them as past, present and future. Basically, enlightened beings, beings who have truly understood the nature of karma, klesha and, you know, habitual patterns, has seen its truth, you know, directly, you know, not just by theory, not just relating to the idea, but direct experience. And so basically, and have then obtained those, and beings who have then obtained the complete realization of then the state of one's inherent quality or nature, the bodhicitta, which is then unaltered, unobscured, you know, by karma, klesha and so on. So the full realization. So beings who have understood them are known as then Buddhas or enlightened beings. So when we say Buddhas, then beings like that. And then the Dharma, basically, what do you call it? The path itself and the result, you know, they are both known as the precious Buddha Dharma, because both of them represent, the ways, in very simple terms, the way, the very way to understand the true nature of the consciousness, or the true nature of the bodhicitta. That its true nature is completely liberated, enlightened, free of, grasping or attachment. Yes? So, therefore, truly, free of attachment. When we take refuge in the Dharma, often the definition of Dharma is stated in few terms, that it says, the absolute, the state of absolute, or the phenomena that is free of attachment. So that describes basically the Buddha Dharma. So the path itself basically guides all of us, helps us on that let's say, path of liberation towards freeing oneself of attachment. And then the result also is, of course, the completion state. You know. So that is the Buddha Dharma. And then thirdly, then the Sangha, in this case, that, as I said earlier, the realized Bodhisattvas. Realized Bodhisattvas meaning that not just beings who carry the name, carries a Bodhisattva name, but who have actually realized, who have actually fulfilled, accomplished the exact features of a Bodhisattva. So, meaning who has gone through the path and obtained the results, you know, and who are on their way to reach the state of perfect enlightenment. So to them, then in short in this shloka, then it says that basically I offer my body, speech and mind in order to accumulate merit. So it's like a summary. So then now for following after that, then it's quite plain in a way, and that's then the various stages of offering. So in here, as I said now, until a few shlokas, it's all about offering things that is belonging to someone or belonging to myself, let's say, you know, things that I can offer actually. Yes. So starting from from the littlest to however we can offer. In the traditional aspect of offering, it is said that from the offerings, from the basically, what do you call it? From the belongings that we have, from the things that we earn, let's say, one part should be kept for oneself in order to sustain, in order to live. But the other two, then normally it is considered, you know, noble and considered virtuous if we keep it as an offering to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So therefore, it could be anything, let's say, little as basically, or simple as, no, let's say, simple as offering of water, offering of lamps, offerings of incense. So that's why it here begins by saying, I offer every fruit and flower, every kind of healing draught, and all the precious gems the world contains, with all pure waters of refreshment. So it's pretty plain and simple to understand. But of course in here, basically, let's say like when it comes to saying fruit or flower, all of that, we try to sort of basically offer whatever we can offer is to begin with. So then it continues onwards. Every mountain root of precious jewels, all sweet and lonely forest groves, the trees of paradise adorned with blossom, trees with branches bound with perfect fruit. I think it's quite plain and simple. The perfumed fragrance of divine and other realms, all incense, wishing trees, and trees of gems, all crops that grow without the tiller's care, and very sumptuous object worthy to be offered. Lakes and meres adorned with lotuses, and delightful with sweet-voiced cries of water birds, and everything unclaimed and free, extending to the margins of the boundless sky. I hold them all before my hand and to the mighty sage, the greatest of our kind, and to his heirs, I make a perfect offering. Sublime recipients, compassionate lords, O think of me, with love, accept these gifts of mine. So, yeah, okay, furthermore, for destitute of merit, I am very poor, I have no other wealth, and so, protectors, you whose wise intentions are for others' good, in your great power, receive them for my sake. So, I think until here, I think most of these offerings are that of the, as I said earlier, offerings that offering things that is that is offerable, you know, that is belonging to us. And so then that's right. So now, of course, unlike ordinary beings, let's say, you know, the enlightened beings, such as Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, in their case, actually, they have no more reason, purpose, need to actually need for offerings from their side. Particularly in the case of the Buddhas, in their case, they have, acquired the most precious thing ever. Let's say, true liberation. So therefore, there is no more need of anything else. In terms of the realized Bodhisattvas, in their cases, maybe there are some things that maybe we can offer. But beside that, mere objects or things that, you know, worldly offerings are actually, of course, not really needed at all. So therefore, in our case of still offering to them, it should be understood only as a way of accumulating merit. So that's why in here it says Aditya Shantideva has said that then, you know, to ask the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas request them to basically receive his offerings for the sake of accumulating merit for the offerer. So Buddhas would often receive such offerings not for their own benefit but for others' benefit. So that's why we would hear many cases where Buddha has accepted as simple as mud, as simple as, you know, earth, a handful of earth, let's say, you know, or a handful of beans and so on. Of course, Buddha has no real need for such things, but simply by accepting it, it automatically generates merit for the offerer. And in turn, then, such as I think the one who has offered the handful of mud or earth later was known as the great emperor Ashoka, and so on. You know, so like that, there are many, many. Even Buddha himself, Buddha Shakyamuni himself, prior to his enlightenment, during his previous rebirths, and then one time he had offered also, I think, basically 7 grains of, beans, yes. And as a result, later, In one of the rebirths, then he was known as one of the greatest, let's say, ruler of the earth. I forget the Sanskrit name, in Tibetan known as Jabongalenu. So, things like that. Basically, for the sake of all sentient beings, for their merit, then the Buddhas would receive such offerings. So therefore, in here, is saying that I'm very poor in a way that maybe poor in terms of maybe just temporarily in terms of maybe the offering objects might be very simple, but of course not truly poor, because if one knows whom to offer, you know, and how to offer, of course it's already very rich in terms of that is very in terms of attitude. Yes. So therefore, if you're able to follow these examples, or at least to begin with imitate, then we will share, you know, the equal amount of merit. Enlightened ones and all your Bodhisattva heirs, I offer you my body throughout all my lives. Supreme courageous ones, accept me totally, for with devotion I will be your slave. Well, of course, this is very poetic, I suppose. otherwise, it could be frowned upon. Maybe more than frowned upon. Basically, the offering of one's body, yes. If I think maybe in a spiritual context, with you know, if you listen to it carefully, of course it makes a lot of sense. Otherwise, if you listen with emotions and so on, in a worldly way, of course it could sound very wrong. Offering of body is basically, again, another way of, let's say, what is it called? Of making sure that it's a direct translation of developing proper conduct, basically, offering a body to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Because offering to them, offering one's, right now we are just talking about the body, yes, basically, our physical, what you call, condition. If you offer to the Buddhas, of course, in absolute, of course, the Buddhas have no use for it, of course. They have no need for it. Let's say, if you forcefully think of, a purpose, let's say, would be none other than to benefit sentient beings. Yes. So therefore, what would be required of our, let's say, physical condition is to, utilize it to its full extent so that it becomes beneficial for benefiting sentient beings, you know, So, that's, I think, how we have to understand this particular shloka. That, or any other, let's say, verses like this in the teachings, and it should be not misunderstood as at all, yes. That is basically a way of saying that I offer my body to the enlightened beings, and enlightened, as always, meaning enlightened from, not just from, let's say, poetically from darkness or this or that, but simply from karma and klesha, let's say. Yes. So therefore, if I offer it, then I will have to follow the same conduct, the same way. So therefore, then basically it's a way to somehow protect, it's a way to not to waste this precious human existence. Yeah? Therefore, if you will accept me, I will be undaunted by samsara and will act for being sake. That's it. I will leave behind the evils of my past and ever after turn my face from them. Maybe the translation is very religious in a way, but the meaning is, of course, to the point. The meaning is there. So, basically, by now following this proper conduct, of course, it automatically one disengages from any kind of misconduct or wrong conduct, or conducts that are harmful to oneself, conducts that are harmful to others. Yes? So that's what. A bathing chamber accidentally fragrant with even floors of crystal, radiant and clear, and graceful pillars shimmering with gems, all hung about with gleaming canopies of pearls. There the blissful Buddhas and their heirs I will bathe with many a precious vase, a brim with water fragrant and delightful, all to frequent strains of melody and song. So, now from here then it is what is known as the offering, offering of the mind, let's say, through the ability of our mind. Yes. Earlier we had the offerings of what we could actually utilize from our own body, speech and mind, mainly that of the body. Now in here then it focuses on the aspect of offerings that we can offer through the ability of our mind. So, by means of meditation, by means of clear mind, then we offer to, again, once again, to Buddhas and Bodhisattvas the best of the best, let's say, yes, to all. So then, for this, then we meditate or we visualize that basically, it says bathing chambers. Yes, bathing chambers, or nowadays we have shower enclosure. You know, very sophisticated ones with very luxurious, let's say, systems of water pressure and so on and so forth. Probably, in terms of in the offerings that we can offer through the ability of our, let's say, through our resources, let's say, material resources. Probably, right now, we may have certain things that maybe we didn't have in the past. Let's say, yes. Anyway, coming back to the subject. Now in this case, of course, through the ability of our mind, we visualize bathing chambers, as it is said here, in front of us. And in terms of the size, timeless, you know, immeasurable. Meaning that it can... that it could appear in front of us in a in full frame, but nevertheless, if you measure it, it's immeasurable. Yes, that the whole universe could fit like that. And then, of course, in here, actually, if you read the commentary, it's in full detail. You know, every aspect of it. And again, the reason is so that, I would say, again, we accumulate that much amount of merit as well. Yes, to reach the state of a perfectly enlightened being, I would say, actually, one goes through all of these troubles. Let's say, you know, various details in terms of benefiting sentient beings, offering to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, so that you accumulate immense merit. As a result, when one has reached that state, then everything is conquerable. You have, I would say, full control, and I would say full that, you know, everything sort of bends to your will, let's say, yeah? In a positive way, of course, without challenge, simply. So the causes are exactly like these, that in terms of just offering, that one focuses on every detail, you know. And of course, these things may look like as if it's very cumbersome and so on, you know, complicated and too elaborate and so on, maybe unnecessary. But actually, it has the ability to, first of all, calm the mind, you know, in terms of direct benefit for ourselves right now as beginners, to calm the mind, to have clarity, you know, in the mind. And of course, when we think of such offerings, if there is an automatic soothing experience, isn't there? Yeah. So, therefore, we meditate such wondrous and beautiful bathing chamber made of, it says crystal here, so therefore, such as not just ordinary crystals, but that are made of, I think in the commentary it says, such as the five different types of, you know, the precious jewels. Such as Padmaraga, Indranila, and so on. All of this, I think in English is diamonds, sapphires, emeralds, and so on. But not just the ordinary types of these such precious gems, but that of, let's say, maybe that of the gods, that of the Nagas, and so on. You know, the purest or the absolute of all. So we meditate that such crystals are basically, its element are of such. And then, of course, it says, yes, with such crystal and radiant floors, as well as graceful pillars. Of course, now we can think like yes. So we can, of course, think in our own way, individual ways of what we think is beautiful. Yes, sometimes there are certain, let's say, styles and visualizations that might not be considered maybe appealing to oneself. In this case, I think there is no real, let's say, limit or, let's say, restriction, that whatever we think it's beautiful, whatever we think it's appropriate, you know, we offer that. So, in terms of now the style that most of the commentaries that we have in Tibetan is often has often a lot of Tibetan influence. So therefore, when we visualize the style of the bathing chamber and so on, it's very much, you know, Tibetan architecture, you know. And so in terms of the canopies and the pillars and so on. So maybe it's appealing to everyone, you know. But not necessarily one has to just restrict oneself to that. Instead, one can think of various beautiful, let's say, you know, forms. In the West you have various, I think, I don't know about now. Now you have very simple and modern way of designs and architectures and interiors. In the past, I think you had also very elaborate ones, yeah. So like that, you know, you can meditate. Similarly, in India again, one would have again various types of designs. So accordingly, one can meditate here. So of course now, so in such chambers, and also not just maybe one chamber, you know, but many, countless also. Basically, just like in the Samantabhadra's aspiration prayer, that first we focus on one particular, let's say, you know, object. In this case, let's say the bathing chamber, and then we focus on its quality and so on, its vastness, its details, and then we multiply that again countlessly. Yes, so that we are able to host countless of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So that's what we say when it's said here that there the blissful Buddhas, so it's not just one or two, but countless, however many they are. And their heirs, the Bodhisattvas also, however many they are. So we bathe them with the most soothing water. Normally, there are also a lot of definitions of this of water, also, you know, such as in Tibetan known as Yenlang Jedenji Chu. So therefore, meaning that basically a water that has eight different types of qualities, you know, so soothing. If you drink it, it's delicious. It's cooling in summer. And so on. It's fragrant, you know. So with such precious water, then we bathe them, and together with it, then it says with melody and song, you know. So meaning that at the same time, we meditate that they are offerings. In terms of tunes, melodies and songs about the qualities of the Buddhas, the qualities of the Bodhisattvas. And then with cloths of unexampled quality, with spotless perfumed towels, I will dry them and offer splendid scented clothes, well dyed and of surpassing excellence. With different garments, light and supple, and 100 beautiful adornments, I will grace sublime Samantabhadra, Manjugosha, Lokeshwara, and their kin. So, therefore, such as now, basically bathing and cleansing oneself. Of course, these are worldly traditions. Of course, noble worldly sort of customs, you know, traditions and so on. But of course, in here, we are not just, how to say, restricting ourselves to the worldly customs, but transforming them into something very virtuous by offering to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And similarly, then we do the same by then offering also the most precious of apparels or clothes to those that represent themselves as the supreme emanation of the Nimanakaya, such as that of the Buddha Shakyamuni. Then we offer them appropriate clothes, such as robes that are made of, again, you know, unsurpassable qualities. So therefore it says spotless, perfumed, and so on, yes? So in that way we meditate that we offer them not just to one Buddha, but again to countless and countless of Buddhas, oceans and oceans of Buddhas. And then similarly, also Buddhas who also represent themselves also in the Sambhogakaya form, such as the, in this case, very simply, like Vajradhara and so on. That to them, then again, we offer appropriate adornments and clothes and so on, crowns, basically all of the you know, attributes and ornaments of the universal monarch. So we offer all of that. And then similarly to the Bodhisattvas, again Bodhisattvas who represent themselves in the in a completely ordained forms, then we offer the appropriate offerings. Similarly to those who also represent themselves as lay, then we also offer them accordingly. So in here, of course, now Samanta Bhatra, Majugash, and so on. So of course, in here, it's they summarized by saying and to their kin. So therefore, we can sort of continue by focusing on the eight. In short, the eight Bodhisattvas, and of course, not just in full, then countless of Bodhisattvas, countless of realized Bodhisattvas. And with the sumptuous fragrance which pervades 1,000,000,000 worlds, I will anoint the bodies of the mighty sages, gleaming bright like burnished gold, refined and cleansed. So then, basically offerings of sight, sound, taste, touch and so on, yeah. So therefore, now in here that of the scent, so therefore the, again, unsurpassable scent, you know, in a good way. there can be also unsurpassable scents in a bad way. So, so therefore offering such fragrances, I believe that probably nowadays might not actually exist, but in the past, very simply, even in terms of scent, the ones one of the rarest ones could actually sort of really calm one's, you know, calm down one's emotions, calm down one's anger, calm down one's confusions and disturbing experiences, you know. There would be such, let's say, you know, quality, you know, such kind of, you know, scents or perfumes with such quality. So, you know, in here, we it says that such qualities that could basically spread to, you know, countless and countless of worlds. So we again offer countless of them to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. I place before the mighty sages perfect objects of my worship, glorious flowers like lotus and the Mandarava, the Utpala, and other fragrant blossoms, worked and twined in lovely scented garlands. I think that's pretty simple to understand. Like the Mandarava and the Utpala, these are, I heard that nowadays also in our own good green earth, we don't, we have less and less of these lotuses or Utpalas or Mandaravas or Ukumutas and so on. You know, these are types of flowers. Probably in the past, I think it did exist. In the past, there would be lotuses or Utpalas with 100 petals, 1,000 petals and so on. But nowadays, I think all we have is mostly something that, you know, resembles close to that, which is like the water lily. Yeah. So therefore, often, let's say, Such flowers are nowadays, or not nowadays, but often nowadays, they are so rare and so precious that it is considered fit for beings with highest of merit, that of the gods. I will offer swelling clouds of, now I don't know how to pronounce this, frankincense, yeah, whose ambient perfume ravishes the mind, and various foods and every kind of drink, all delicacies worthy of the gods. I will offer perfume lamps arranged in rows on lotuses of gold, a carpet of sweet flowers scattering upon the level, incense sprinkled ground. So now offerings of incense, offerings of delicacies, foods, basically light or lamps. So all of this I think by now it's very it's understood that in terms of quality it has to be that of the best, and that one could sort of capture with our mind. Yes, simply these are offerings that we are offering with the ability of our mind. Of course, there is no way of measuring it, but nevertheless, whatever we can capture, you know. To those whose very nature is compassion, I will give vast palaces resounding with fair praise, all decked with precious pearls and beauteous pendant gems, gleaming jewels that deck the amplitude of space. Amplitude of space. Excuse me. Fair and precious parasols adorned with golden shafts, all bordered round with hems of precious jewels, upright, well proportioned, pleasing to the eye. Again, all this I give to all the Buddhas. So I think it's pretty simple. May a host of other offerings and clouds of ravishing sweet melody that solaces the pain of living beings arise and constantly abide. May rains of flowers and very precious gem fall down in an unceasing stream upon the jewels of the sacred Dharma, images and all supports for offering. Just as Manjugosha and the like made offering to all the conquerors, I do likewise to all the Buddhas, our protectors, and to all their Bodhisattva children. To these vast oceans of good qualities I offer praise, a sea of airs and harmonies. May clouds of tuneful eulogy ascend unceasingly before them. So in the same way, we offer to the various, objects of offering, you know, such as then various representations of enlightened beings, various representations of bodhisattvas, and then we meditate that not only for just this temporary moment that we do the offering, but at all times. Yes, that as long as their presence is present, and that one offers one's offerings to them, accordingly or timelessly. Of course, later on we will also ask them, ask such Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to also remain not just for limited time, but for a limited time, but countlessly. I think the actual way of asking for them is that as long as they are sentient beings, may their presence will always be there. So, therefore, accordingly, we make merits. We make these offerings. We practice these ways of offerings, so that it continues to generate merits countlessly. So this is the ways how previous bodhisattvas, previous Buddhas have practiced. So that's why saying that, just like the Manjukosha, then in the same way, then I offer to the conquerors, meaning the conquerors of the Mara, meaning the Buddha, and that to all of them, and I will, offer in the same way. To Buddhas of the past, the present, and all future time, in the Dharma, in the sublime assembly, with bodies many as the grains of dust upon the earth, I will prostrate and bow. To shrines and all supports of Bodhicitta, I bow down. To abbots who transmit the vows, to every learned masters, and to all sublime practitioners of the Dharma, so of Dharma. Until the essence of enlightenment is reached, I go for refuge to the Buddhas. I also take refuge in the Dharma and in all the host of the Bodhisattvas. So therefore now, having offered the merits, the various merits, meaning merits that of offering things that one can offer, offering things that not belonging to us, offering things through the ability of our mind, and then offering through our speech, and with these various offerings, then we would have now accumulated immense merit as a foundation. And so then now we have a proper foundation where we can sort of cultivate something precious. So therefore, now then in here is the, is the part where we take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. To perfect Buddhas and to Bodhisattvas in all directions where they may reside, to them who are the sovereign of great mercy, I press my palms together and praying thus. In this and all my other lives, while turning in the round without beginning, blindly I have brought forth evil and incited others to commit the same. Deceived and overmastered by my ignorance, I have taken pleasure in such sin. And seeing now the blame of it, O great practitioners, I confess it earnestly. Whatever I have done against the Triple Gem, against my parents, teachers, and the rest, through force of my defilements,
in my body, speech and mind, all the evil I, as sinner, have committed, all the wicked deeds that cling to me, the frightful things and I contrived, I openly declare to you, the teachers of the world. So, now I think, yes, the last one. It may be that my death will come to me before my evils has been cleansed. However, then, can I be free from it? I pray you, quickly grant me your protection. So, it's a very traditional, let's say, particularly a presentation or orientation of taking refuge, particularly during the time, how do I say, when Dhamma was flourishing during the 8th century, let's say, around that time. So therefore, as I'm saying, that is very traditional, because probably by this translation one might think that it's too religious, let's say, you know. So therefore, is it, maybe one could have some questions about it. So that's why I'm saying it's very traditional, yes. So therefore, one is very sort of traditional, meaning, but particularly, Dharma has to adapt, or not that Dharma has to adapt, but when it's taught according to different times, according to different cultures, it always sort of has to somehow adapt to that mentality, yes. So simply because nowadays we think that we have a modern mentality, so therefore if the teaching doesn't adapt to it, we don't feel comfortable about it, yes. If the way that is taught right now, if it was taught then, again, similar effect, there might be confusions about it. So therefore, it's important that we look at this, that okay, this is how it was taught, you know, and so that then one doesn't accumulate any kind of unnecessary karmas by questioning these translations. So, no matter how traditional these aspects of presentation or orientation of taking refuge, of how presentations of purification, presentations of looking at karma, presentations of various aspects of the spirituality, particularly in the Buddha Dharma, no matter how traditional they are, they still have, you know, great weight. That's something that we should not disregard. We should examine it carefully, and then we can translate it to the a way that is understandable to our, let's say, you know, our mentality. Yeah. So then, now of course, in terms of purification, because now from here, first one takes the refuge from the Buddha Dharma and Sangha. And now in terms of purification, then we would need the most, let's say, we would need a supreme witness, basically, yes? Only then we're able to, let's say now, openly sort of, kind of like, I don't like using the word confess, but nevertheless, to openly sort of discuss, to openly share, you know. So, it's a way of opening up, rather than to sort of confess something that one may think that the one has committed, and therefore there is a sense of guilt, and there's a sense of shamefulness, and so on. But more than that, something actually quite different from that, which is that, first of all, one must understand that, of course, in here is very traditionally explained that it says, while turning in round, without beginning, blindly I have brought forth evil.
and then incited others to commit the same. And similarly then, deceived and overmastered by my ignorance, I have taken pleasure in such, you know. So of course it sounds very traditional, yeah. But basically, the way, well, personally I feel that one should look at it is that the negativities in here described as evil or sin, all of these actually generated, let's say, without knowing, very simply, yes. So therefore it's not truly intentional actually, yeah. Because if it's intentional, then maybe we can use certain words to describe it. But often I think negativities are accumulated unintentionally. That's the way I see it. That they are accumulated out of, very simply, the, in English term, ignorance. Of course, that's also a very questionable terminology to use to describe marigpa. But otherwise, not knowing, or lack of knowledge, lack of experience, you know, we often accumulate, often these negativities or negative karmas are accumulated simply because of lack of experience, yeah. So, lack of awareness. So, then when one has committed over and over again, it becomes a habit, first of all. And so that lack of, experience, which, so begins to sort of aggregate and become bigger and bigger, to a point it almost starts to seem like as if that is my nature, that is my sort of inseparable nature, let's say, you know. So then there is a lot of confusion, and then there is, it could lead to a point where one thinks that one has intentionally accumulated negative karmas or negative thoughts, you know, and so on. So therefore, if you are able to understand it like that, probably, you know, it might help us, you know, to understand better. But whatever be it, whatever we have accumulated, in terms of the karma, its system or its is such that it's unfailing again. That whatever one has accumulated, if it is not countered with the right or correct remedies, then the result is inevitable. So that's why the first way of applying the remedy is to openly share, let's say. Of course, now it's difficult to open up just like that randomly to a stranger. Yes, it's very difficult. So therefore, it begins with, let's say, you know, sharing of this experience, sharing of this part to none other than the unfailing witnesses, the most supreme of, let's say, witnesses, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So in front of them, then we, let's say, now in this case, maybe we can use the word confess, you know, the various negativities. So normally, when one takes refuge, of course, it's often because there is something to escape from. There's a sense or urgency of a protection. Yes, that is why it's called refuge, or in Tibetan, gyamdo, no, gyapsumdo, for someone's sanctuary or for someone's protection. So, therefore, says at the end that I pray to you and quickly grant me your protection. So. Yes, there is sort of an obvious, you know, sense of protection in terms of taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Automatically there's a blessing where it can help in a worldly way, you know, to protect oneself from various obstacles, for sure. But of course, if you ask ourselves, is that everything? Then most likely not. You know, there is a there is something more to let's say to fear against, or there is something, there is a urgency or a need of a greater protection, rather than the, you know, the outer what do you call you know, fears that that come outerly. Rather, you know, there are things that one needs to protect, you know, oneself, you know, from within. So therefore, as we you know, understand, or as we delve, you know, more and more into the practice of the refuge, then you know, we must also look at it in that way as well, in particularly in the case of the meaning of protection. So then I think today we will pause it there, and we will continue onwards tomorrow from the verse 33. Today I think we are stopping here at verse 32. Yes. So if you wish, we will have just three questions.
Dear Kaimapa, thank you very much for your teachings. My question consider offering, and what about offering of positive emotions? Can we offer them as well, such as love, happiness, because we also experience this kind of feelings, and they are also very pleasant, so can we do it?
Actually, it's a very good question, yes. In that context, not only we can offer positive emotions, actually I have a little challenge in understanding exactly what the word emotion means, you know. If it relates to the word nyomong in Tibetan, really. So therefore, this is something that I have to study, and you all should study as well. Yeah. But besides that, we can offer, in terms of, let's say, positive experiences, let's say, maybe, you know, something that makes us maybe laugh, or something that makes us maybe just pleasant. We can offer all of that, of course. But not only that, we can even offer our negative emotions as well.
How come?
Negative emotions, in particularly negative, probably negative might not exactly also describe it the right way. Afflictive emotions, we can offer that, such as anger, such as pride, all of that we can also offer. And offering, of course, often when we use the term offering, naturally it makes us think of offering something that is pleasing to us, yes? So if it's pleasing to me, it should be pleasing to them. So therefore, because I feel I have a, you know, sense of respect and gratitude, therefore I would like to offer something that is profound, pleasant, you know, and so on. But of course, to the Buddhas, as I said, of course, they have no real need of such things. They will only accept it if it benefits the offerer. So therefore, we can also offer our afflictive emotions as well, you know. We can offer our hatred. We can offer our anger and so on. Simply because, of course, with the understanding that it's a way of letting go, you know. Letting go of such afflictive emotions. And if you do it that way, Buddha will actually receive it. That's the thing. Yeah.
and it's not harming.
No, it's not harmful. It cannot harm them, first of all. And secondly, it will not harm us as well. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, two more to go.
Good afternoon, Karmapa.
Oh, yes, hello.
Karmapa, I have often felt this thing that the basis of Buddha Dharma is like whatever wishes we are making for others, and so that for a greater good, basically. Yeah. So when we are making wishes, like in a normal daily, day-to-day life, like this happens to me, or I need this thing, and you know, in general life. Does not it contradicts with the practice of renunciation? Because if I would not practice in my mind the renunciation, like let go, then it would like how is it contradictory with making wishes and renunciating my desires?
So your question is that
there is a contradiction, like making wishes mm-hmm. and renunciating my desires.
Ah, okay, very good.
Good question.
So in this case, I feel that it might not exactly contradict. You know, of course, it depends on when we wish, what kind of intention you know drove us to make wishes. You know.
Okay.
In a particular wishes.
The motivation.
Yeah. So it depends on that, I think. Otherwise, it goes hand in hand. It supports each other. Yes. Simply because one is making wishes actually to renounce. Of course, first of all, one must check if there's anything to renounce. If there's nothing to renounce, perfect. Yes. But if there is something to renounce, then, of course, that's the first step. Then one has that priority set straight, you know, then one can focus on the various aspirations and wishes and so on, which will supplement, you know, the renouncement, okay. You know, the practice of renouncement.
Okay.
So therefore, of course, you would wish for positive conditions so that, you know, the path is, you know, clearer and safer and so on. Yeah.
Like clearing the obstacles.
Sure, okay. Sure.
Thank you. Thank you, Karma.
Thank you.
Okay, Karmapa, thank you for the teachings. I have two and one question. the one is, I hope it's not too stupid. My question is, are you enlightened? The reason why I ask is yesterday I met you for the first time, and I never met the 16th Karmapa, but all people said he was definitely enlightened, so you must be enlightened too. But that's why you must be a Buddha, but when you're not a Buddha, you must be a Bodhisattva on a very high level. And so the next question is, why a Buddha or Bodhisattva have to learn the things you learn in this life which he has learned in the last life, or can you remember at such teachings of last life? Thank you.
In terms of the first question is basically the both the questions, the answer to it is, excuse me. Personally, from my own experience, yes, is that I think perfect enlightenment is definitely a long way. It's not to discourage ourselves, for sure. I'm not saying that, you know, saying it with that intention. yes. But to be realistic, yes, because reaching of enlightenment in general and then perfect enlightenment is truly a long way, considering what kind of challenges we have. That doesn't mean that it's hopeless. we have the means, our consciousness intact, is intact. We have the most wonderful of, opportunities, yes, in terms of practicing the Dharma and being able to share and exchange this wonderful teaching. So therefore there's a lot of hope, for sure. So it's a long way, but not that hard also, you know, not that impossible. Is it long? It is long. So that's the way I feel, let's say, also about myself, that to reach that stage, it's definitely a long way. But let us say, do I remember anything from the past? Do I feel anything? Do I remember? Or let's say some things that maybe comes to me maybe much easier, you know, than regular, let's say, in regular circumstances. Yes, there are many things like that. Starting from very small, I would say there have been many, let's say, experiences like that for sure. But in this case, I must say that lack of practice in life, yes, in everyday life, if there's a lack of practice, it does obscure. You know, it does obscure that whatever, let's say, quality or insight you have. So therefore, I see the importance of focusing on practice, very, very crucial. And the more you are able to give time in meditation, in practice, particularly application. Application meaning that whatever you have listened or studied first, on top of it, whatever you have meditated formally, all of this finally has to be applied, yes, in daily life. If not, it's just the practice becomes separate from one's life. So therefore, it's the application that somehow makes the practice, you know, a part of one's life, or the other way around. So therefore, application in terms of maybe applying the littlest of patience, let's say, in areas maybe in the past one might have had difficulty in applying, you know. So things like that really helps actually in sort of now gaining, that is, whatever quality that one has gained already, to sort of, if it's been obscured, to sort of, you know, to cleanse it, to purify it, let's say. So since you've had a very constructive and good question, I thought that maybe I should come up with a similar one, you know, in terms of an answer.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So then now we shall dedicate our merit. So that whatever merit we have accumulated doesn't go to waste or leak.
Sanam deyen tamje zembanye tamne nyeben danam bhamje ne jega nanje balav tu sibim solen rova dolvarai shoo.